This is Statewide, conversations and reports from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, is there help on the way for Illinois' horse racing industry? We'll have a report. We also look back 25 years ago to the Great Flood of 1993.
We hope it is a once-in-a-lifetime event, but we're not so sure now because we're moving towards wetter conditions across Illinois and the Midwest.
There's a new program to help some students attend private schools. What do the early numbers show? And in Springfield, remembering a race riot that took place more than a century ago.
It's been kept quiet for years and years and years, and I personally think that the truth needs to be told about it so that we don't repeat this craziness that's going on in our country even today.
Stay with us for Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we learn about efforts to bring more revenue to the struggling Illinois horse racing industry. A storm took away a piece of Midwest history, a barn, but it will live on through art, we'll explain. And Rachel Otwell tells us how a dark chapter in Springfield's history is being remembered over a century later. That and more coming up, all this hour on Statewide. Well, as students across the state head back to school, districts are operating under a brand new funding formula. That formula was hammered out by lawmakers after years of fierce debate, ultimately settled by four legislative leaders meeting behind closed doors. Their key to compromise? The creation of a tax credit program for private school donors, which is also going into effect this year. Linda Lutton of member station WBEZ has been digging into that program. She sat down with our education reporter, Dusty Rhodes.
Hi, Linda.
Hi, Dusty.
I think we should start with you explaining for people who call this, in a shorthand way, a voucher program, how it is or isn't similar to a voucher program.
Well, in the case of vouchers, the state takes money from its coffers and puts it toward families who can use the voucher for private school tuition. The money in this program is donated by taxpayers who then get a credit on their taxes. They are essentially reimbursed by the state. They get 75 cents on the dollar. But all the money is handled by authorized nonprofits. The money actually never goes to the state. The nonprofits take donations, and they're the ones who pass out the scholarships. So for donors, this becomes a way to channel their income taxes directly to private schools. But for kids in schools, this program works exactly like school vouchers. In fact, tax credit scholarships have been called neo-vouchers. More kids in the country now attend private school on these types of tax credit scholarships than they do on vouchers. They're really replacing vouchers.
So it's kind of a workaround since our state law prohibits sending public money to religious schools.
Absolutely. This is a way to get around state laws, sometimes called Blaine Amendments, and Illinois has one of these, that would prohibit public dollars going to religious schools. This is the workaround.
So the nonprofits that handle this money are called scholarship granting organizations, and I think we have 9 of them, right? Do they get a cut of this money?
Yep. The law allows the scholarship granting organizations to take 5% of all donations for their administrative costs, for the cost of running these programs. 18 states have these tax credit scholarship programs. I believe all of them allow the nonprofits to take something for the cost of administration. Usually it's between 5 and 20%. Again, in Illinois, it's 5%. In some states, these scholarship groups have become like a cottage industry. Georgia has 30 scholarship granting organizations. Arizona has 62. You mentioned Illinois has 9. That's just in our first year. In Pennsylvania, where the scholarship groups can take more money for their administrative fee, they can take up to 20%. There are 189 of these groups administering one of the tax credit scholarships in Pennsylvania. 258 groups administer another one. That really makes oversight a tremendous challenge, monitoring and regulating these scholarship groups and whether they're following process and rules set out by the state. It's important to remember that these groups are essentially handling money that's been you know, this is diverted taxpayer dollars going to nonprofits. They do have to file reports, but there is no real-time monitoring going on.
So for those of us who worked at the State House and watched this school funding battle for years, it was a little frustrating when at the very last minute, everything got settled by the four tops, as we call them, the four legislative leaders who met behind closed doors and came up with this plan. They all happened to be guys who went to Catholic school. So it was kind of frustrating that we never got to ask any questions. We never had any hearings. There was no transparency. Now that it's rolled out, is there any more transparency? Like, how much can you see into the process?
Well, I think you're right to point out a lot was missed because this piece of legislation was not debated. No hearings were held. Some of the things surprised me as a reporter looking into this. For instance, when you hold Illinois' program up to other programs, you see there are several aspects of Illinois' program that make our tax credit scholarship program huge. For instance, no other state has kicked off with a bigger program. Illinois is allowing $75 million in taxpayer money to be diverted to scholarships, you know, in this first year. Just as a comparison, Indiana began its program at $14 million. Iowa, I believe, started with a $12 million program. Another aspect, Illinois is giving very generous credits to individual taxpayers. Again, in other states, let's take Arizona. That's where tax credit scholarships were born. If I'm filing as an individual taxpayer in Arizona, I can get a tax credit of around $1,100 today. In Illinois, I can get $1 million tax credit. And our scholarships are also really, really big, the biggest in the country, in fact. Again, maybe something we would have learned if there had been debate around the program. Students can get up to almost $13,000 this year. That's slated to go up. It's tied to the cost of public school education here. You know, these scholarships are sometimes criticized because they're often not big enough to cover the total cost of tuition. Illinois' scholarship amount really allows most private school kids to pay the full cost of tuition. But the transparency aspect you bring up, I think, is a challenge for people wanting to monitor this program. For instance, I asked one of the scholarship groups to tell me where scholarship applicants and scholarship winners live. They declined to provide that information, and the public has no way to see it right now. We will eventually have access to that sort of data, I hope in a complete way, around February. But there would be ways to improve transparency in this program. For instance, charter schools, which take public money but are privately run. Charter schools in the state of Illinois are subject to Illinois' Open Records Act, meaning reporters like you and I can use the Freedom of Information Act to ask questions and get data. Why not make these scholarship granting organizations subject to FOIA as well?
I would imagine it would also be frustrating to families who've applied and not gotten scholarships to not know why.
Absolutely. I am really seeing that on social media. I'm hearing it from parents who are calling, who are saying, how do I know I got a fair shake, basically?
So, you know, now that it's rolled out, how is it working out?
Well, demand for the scholarships has been huge. We can absolutely say that. Demand for scholarships is far outstripping supply. And this is the very first year. I think it's fair to say that many families haven't even heard of the scholarships yet. Still, tens of thousands of kids applied. We know that. Another thing we know, and this is through legwork, we aren't getting these numbers from the state, but the scholarship granting organizations did answer questions from WBEZ. We know that 5,600 children have received scholarships up to now and will be starting private school in the fall for the first time in Illinois history, being paid for in part by taxpayer dollars. We also know this program has attracted less than half the donations allowed. But I'll also point out, you know, we're not to the end of the calendar year yet. We still have the entire sort of giving season to go through. And I imagine seeing many more contributions come in around the end of the year. Sort of another thing we're learning here, we know this program was pitched as a way to help low-income kids attend the school of their choice. But WBEZ found 28% of the scholarships so far have gone to kids who would not qualify for free and reduced price lunch. So almost a third, somewhere between a quarter and a third of the scholarships going to kids who aren't considered low income. That's because some of the program's rules actually let higher income kids jump ahead in the scholarship line in certain cases. That's what's happening here. Another thing we're seeing anecdotally so far, but this is something that's happened in other states as well, that many, many scholarship winners were already attending private school.
You know, one thing about Illinois' law is that it's supposed to sunset in 5 years. Do you foresee that happening?
No tax credit scholarship program in the country, once it's been started, has ever been repealed. Illinois' program, like you said, is supposed to sunset in 5 years, but really with every additional taxpayer donation, you know, the number of kids who have scholarships and the number of families invested in this program increases. That only means more and more supporters. One of the scholarship groups, Empower Illinois, that's the group that wrote and lobbied for this legislation and is now benefiting from it as the largest scholarship granting organization. You know, that group is already out there organizing schools and parents to pressure lawmakers to continue this program beyond the sunset.
Okay, well, so this Invest in Kids Act, which got no debate in the legislature, we've had our own little discussion here, and we will continue it. Thank you, Linda, for being the person digging all this information out.
Thank you, Dusty.
Next up on Statewide, severe weather ripped through Van Buren County, Iowa, back on July 19th. It damaged a county building, a lumber yard, and other nearby properties. The storm also took a piece of the county's history with it, but not before its image could be captured on canvas. Tri-State's Public Radio's Jason Parrott has that story.
Sherry Dill Billings of New London, Iowa, is one of about a dozen artists who took part in an open-air painting competition as part of the Van Buren County Fair.
I love to paint, and now that I'm semi-retired, this is what I do, and I thought it was a beautiful weekend to do this.
The artists had 48 hours to paint outdoor scenes in the county. Dill Billings and several other artists drove out on Highway 1 to the historic Galloway Barn. Dill Billings says she fell in love with the barn while growing up in nearby Fairfield.
My sister and I always joked around that when we retired, we were going to have a bed and breakfast, and this was going to be it. So this was exactly the farm, which was our dream. So when we came back, I go, I got to paint this barn. This is something that was always special to me.
Dill Billings visited the barn twice on July 19th. Her painting shows the barn at 1 in the afternoon, with dark shadows falling beneath the overhanging roof and a slight purple haze to the clouds. The Galloway Barn was built in the late 1880s. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1999, so Brad Clode of Milton is quite familiar with it. He manages the Barns of Van Buren County, Iowa Facebook page. He says most of the historic barns in the county are small. They were designed to handle a milk cow and a team of horses. But the Galloway Barn was different. It towered about 150 feet above the landscape. It had white wooden walls, a solid stone foundation, and four rows of windows.
Originally it was built as a loose hay and livestock barn, and it's a basement barn.
That means it was built into the side of a hill. Clote says that allowed more livestock to be housed in the barn, and it improved the structural stability. But the 1880s design was no match for Mother Nature in 2018. The National Weather Service says two EF1 tornadoes touched down near Keosauqua on July 19th, with peak winds of around 100 miles per hour. Steve Kissling of Keosauqua was driving on Highway 1 during the storm. He planned to stop at the Galloway Barn to wait it out, but he missed the driveway. By the time he spotted the barn, it was leaning over.
And then all of a sudden, I looked, and then I looked back, and it was going up in the air. And it went, I don't know how to gauge it, there's nothing around it, but I would say at least 10 feet off the ground.
Kissling says he drove off after seeing the barn destroyed, fighting to keep his vehicle on the road at times. He says it was tough to watch because the barn had been there his entire life. He even helped load cattle out of that barn. And if the situation was tough for Kissling, it was even harder for the owner of the barn.
If you're a good walker, I'm going to ride my little mower out there.
Sharon Galloway owns the barn. It's been in her family for about 60 years. We met at her farm about 18 hours after the tornado hit. She agrees to show me the pile of rubble that remains. Galloway climbs onto a little orange lawnmower with handles instead of a steering wheel. She says it's the one she uses to mow the grass. Galloway drives out of her detached garage, crosses the driveway, and motors past a couple small grain bins. She did slow down to offer a warning to me.
Don't touch the wire. We don't know for sure.
The downed power line leads to the debris field. Galloway reaches it first. Once I catch up, we stand on a concrete slab looking out.
Oh, I feel like crying, but I'm very thankful it wasn't the house and nobody got hurt. I just cannot believe it.
Galloway says this is the first time she's seen the damage up close. She and her husband were in nearby Farmington during the storm, and she did not look at the pile of rubble when they got home. Galloway learned about the damage from her daughter, Mary Dawn Shuck, who drove by after the storm passed. Shuck's memories of the barn date back to her childhood.
When I was little, I have a brother who's 2 years older and a sister who's 4 years older, and we used to play out there all the time, and there would always be cats and, you know, kind of play hide and go seek and all that kind of stuff.
Shuck and Galloway estimate that more than 100 kids in Van Buren County played in that barn over the decades, creating memories for all. Now the Galloway barn is gone, but the family's memories remain, and that's not all. Four artists competing in the open-air art competition submitted paintings of the more than 125-year-old barn, images that captured what it looked like during its final hours. Dill Billings did not win one of the cash prizes for her painting, but it won the heart of Sharon Galloway, who agreed to buy it.
It just looked so realistic. It looked exactly like I have seen it all these years. So I loved it.
And what's it feel like to know that it's going home with her?
I am so thrilled that it's going home with her. And, you know, it that's where it needs to be. And, you know, you want the people to have your pieces of work that absolutely love it. And because it's a memory of hers, and a part of their family, that it couldn't go on to a better person.
Galloway bought three of the four paintings of her family's barn. The fourth went to Brad Clote with Barns of Van Buren County, Iowa. Galloway says she might hang on to the paintings in her home, or she might give them to her children. She does not know yet. What she says she does know is that when she looks at them, she will remember the family barn and all of the memories created there. I'm Jason Parrott.
Coming up next on Statewide, the state climatologist remembers the Great Flood of 1993, 25 years later. We're back on Statewide, and just ahead, the latest push to bring more attention and more money into Illinois' horse racing industry. But first, Governor Bruce Rauner signed into law a slew of legislation this month intended to alleviate Illinois' teacher shortage. But some teachers and union leaders doubt the measures are enough. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines spoke with Linda Darling Hammond to find out what legislative fixes actually work. Darling Hammond is the president and CEO of the Learning Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that's researched teacher shortages throughout the country.
Teacher shortages can be solved very quickly, and we've had that experience. I've watched states put in place a package of reforms that eliminated shortages within 3 years and put those states into a surplus situation. But you have to actually be purposeful and focused if you're going to make a difference in what is right now a slippery slope toward more and more people coming in without the training that they need, creating a high turnover situation that at the end of the day undermines both teachers and students.
I'm curious whether or not you've seen any states where they've been able to turn it around and what they've done to do that.
Yeah, there are some states that are really beginning to turn around the teacher shortage, and a number of them are raising teacher salaries. We've seen big salary increases in Washington State, in South Dakota, and other states. A large number of states are putting in place service scholarships or forgivable loans for people to train to become teachers. The debt load to become a teacher is pretty extensive. So if you can get rid of people's debt, it's actually like raising the salary. And if you say to people, if you will teach, we'll pay for your education, and tie that to service in the places where teachers are needed, turns out you can really make a big dent in the teacher shortage that way. And I would say there are about 20 states that have put those kinds of programs in place.
One thing that I picked up on from the folks that I've talked to, they feel as though the profession just isn't as respected as it once was.
I think there is a real concern about the respect given to the teaching profession. We've been through a decade where kind of politically there was a lot of teacher bashing as more and more childhood poverty, homelessness, lack of health care, food insecurity has grown, and the context of teaching have become more challenging. Teachers have often been blamed for the failure of the society to support children and to support schools generally. We've had large budget cuts for schools, and rather than really investing in children and schools, we've had a period of time where many politicians have blamed teachers for all of the ills of society that they are also subject to.
What would be the advice that you would give to lawmakers and community leaders in Illinois who expressed concern about reversing our current shortage?
The first thing I would say is communicate the value of teachers and make good on that communication by saying, if you will teach, particularly in our high-need subjects and our high-need locations, we will pay for your education, and you'll pay us back with service and teaching. And I guarantee you that a well-funded program like that will make a very big dent in shortages in a very short period of time. In addition, to keep people, you need to gradually raise salaries and equalize them so that people are earning close to what other college graduates are making. You've got to be sure that they're getting good coaching and mentoring in the classroom when they get in there, and then given opportunities to continue to learn and to get better at what they do, because that will bring them the rewards of children who are learning and the satisfaction that they came into the profession for in the first place.
That's Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines speaking with Linda Darling-Hammond, the president and CEO of the Learning Policy Institute, a nonprofit research group based in Palo Alto, California. Next, the Illinois horse racing industry has had some tough years. Revenues are dipping, along with the number of people who place bets, but some racetrack owners are looking at a potential solution they say could keep the industry afloat. For this week's Illinois Issues, Mary Hansen spent a day at the races to find out more.
Not a seven horses in first place. Come on, seven!
John Lucas and his granddaughter McKenna bet on the number seven horse, Saber Rattler, at the Fairmont Racetrack on a recent Tuesday afternoon. Lucas has been visiting the track outside of St. Louis a few times a year since the 1980s, traveling across the Illinois border from O'Fallon, Missouri.
Come on, seven!
Lucas has noticed the steady downturn in fortunes for the track.
Because in the past, like in other years, they've had the buggy races and all kind of race like four or five times a week. Now they're just down to racing two times a week.
Fairmont stopped harness racing in 2000 when track president Brian Zander says they really started to feel the competition from the new riverboat casinos in the region. And the problems have continued. There's less prize money to offer and fewer races are held.
So we've had to kind of look internally and see if there was something that we could do, because otherwise, if we can't stem the loss of horses that are leaving Illinois to go to race in other states that have slot machines, we're not going to have a product very soon.
So Zander, as well as executives at another racetrack in suburban Chicago, have asked the Illinois Racing Board, which oversees the industry, to look into what's called historic horse racing. It's a form of video gambling on past horse races, and Zander says he feels like it's one of the few options they have left. The tracks have lobbied unsuccessfully for years, trying to get slot machines or other betting games approved by the legislature. To Zander, it's a matter of competition.
In Indiana, Iowa, other states, they have money from slot machines that go towards purses.
The money that would be gambled at slot machines or historic horse racing terminals could be added to the purses being offered, and bigger prizes would attract more competitive trainers and jockeys, boosting attendance and revenues at the tracks. The proposal is still in the early stages. The Illinois Racing Board agreed to draft some rules, and it could take a few months before anything is voted on. But the idea faces opposition. Critics say this is an expansion of gambling, and only state lawmakers have the power to do that.
It's just an end run around the legislature, and we don't think this is right. We don't think the board has a statutory authority.
That's Anita Bedell, longtime anti-gambling advocate. Bedell points out that a similar strategy has been tried in other states unsuccessfully. The racing board in Texas drew up its own rules on historic horse racing in 2014. The rules led to a battle between lawmakers and board members, including threats of pulling funding from the state agency, which would have shuttered the racetracks. The Texas Racing Board eventually repealed its rules in 2016. Beyond those legal concerns, Bedell says historic horse racing games look a lot like the slot machines that the horse racetracks have been begging for years.
There's a little window that you could watch a past race, but you can override that, and most people don't watch the race. They just bet on the machine like a slot machine.
Jeffrey Brinkett, chair of the Illinois Racing Board, says it might be too early to judge what machines could look like. He was on the committee that researched the legal issues of historic horse racing, or HHR, and he defends the board's decision.
We're faced with trying to do what we can from a regulatory point of view to help this industry, help it survive, not flourish, because HHR will not cause anyone to flourish here in Illinois.
In his view, the move is essentially a Band-Aid until state lawmakers allow slot machines or other forms of gambling at the racetracks.
Fourth race coming up at 6 furlongs. It's claiming.
Back at Fairmont, the jockeys and trainers will keep racing while track officials try to get this proposal over the finish line. I'm Mary Hansen.
Lucky in life.
Lawmakers met in Chicago recently to talk about gambling expansion proposals, including slot machines and table games for racetracks, but nothing is likely to move forward until at least after the November elections. Listening to Statewide. Earlier in the program, we heard a report from Tri-States Public Radio based at Western Illinois University. In the last few days, it was announced the campus will stop funding the radio station. That'll happen early next year. Tri-States Public Radio's news director, Rich Egger, has more details.
The administration says the radio station will become a self-funded department within the university structure on March 1st. That means Tri-States Public Radio will be responsible for generating enough revenue to meet all of its financial needs, including personnel. The university currently funds the full-time salaries for 9 of the radio station's 12 staff positions. The university also provides space on its Macomb campus for the station's main broadcast studios. I asked President Jack Thomas how the administration decides which programs and services to invest in and which ones to zero out or reduce funding for.
Well, we want to save as many faculty and staff as possible, and that's what we have been doing. And we've been trying not to cut as in terms of the nucleus, in terms of the academic programs and so forth. So a rule of thumb is that you cut as many services as you can, as if you have to. But that's just the rule of thumb and how we do. But decisions are being made, and we'll continue to review.
I'm going to ask you about a particular program or service. It's the one that's on this mic flag. Mm-hmm. What goes into the decision to zero fund that?
Well, we have had various discussions and looking at various services, as I stated, and we just looked at those things that are not as a part of the nucleus of the education. We know that everything is important to us, but when we get to a situation, we have to make those tough decisions.
Do you look at all at reducing the funding and trying to keep a service like that going, or why the decision to just completely axe it?
Rich, you are directly affected by this, and I don't want to continue this discussion because it's getting personal.
I'm just asking questions. I think the audience would want to know what goes into that decision-making process.
We all sit down and we make decisions based on what's best for the institution.
But Tri-State's Public Radio General Manager Jonathan All says no one from the administration or Board of Trustees sat down and made decisions with him. He says he did work on a plan with Billy Clow, who's the Dean of the College of Fine Arts and Communication at Western. All says their proposal would have included significant savings for the university while keeping the station functioning mostly as it does right now. But All says the plan was never considered.
We were not allowed to present that alternative to the provost, the president, or the Board of Trustees.
Tri-State's Public Radio received confirmation through email that its funding will be eliminated. In that statement, President Thomas refers to public television station WQPT, which is housed on the university's campus in the Quad Cities. The TV station has paid for its own operating funds, including personnel expenses, since Western acquired it in 2010. Thomas says Tri-State's Public Radio should have to do the same. But All says comparing WQPT to Tri-State's Public Radio is a false equivalency.
WQPT is a television station in a metropolitan area, the Quad Cities, and their signal reaches about 1 million people. We are a radio station in an incredibly rural area, and even with 4 different signals, we get to less than 250,000 people. So to think that we can, with the media market we operate in, be an equivalent to them is simply not true.
All also says large businesses and organizations in the Quad Cities have foundations that offer grant money that's available to WQPT. There is nothing similar in Western Illinois, Southeast Iowa, or Northeast Missouri. All says the radio station is still exploring its options. He says Tri-State's Public Radio will continue to exist, but significant changes will be made to the programming and the staffing unless the funding decision is undone. Rich Egger reporting.
After this piece was produced, WIU's President Jack Thomas issued a statement saying the station will continue to have a home at the university, but its financial obligations must be met through non-appropriated fund sources. He went on to say, in challenging budget times, the university can no longer operate as it has done in the past. We'll continue to watch this story. Thanks for being with us on Statewide, and we hope you join us again next week at this time. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. Listening to Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, Springfield's violent past and how it's being remembered more than a century later. This year marks the 25th anniversary of what's known as the Great Flood of 1993. State climatologist Jim Angel covered that event, and he talked with Daisy Contreras about what took place and what we can expect in the future.
Now, looking at the science, what conditions led to the flooding? Was the amount of rainfall unusual during that time?
Yeah, so the amount of rainfall was extraordinary. We had some areas in Illinois that had over 30 inches over a three-month period, and some places in Iowa that got over 40 inches. So that's about a year's worth of rain in 3 months. So that's what it boils down to. So it's widespread rain. Also, it was pretty relentless, and it was day after day after day of heavy rainfall. So in a more typical flood situation, you get a big rain event, and then you recover from that, and you can move on. But in this case, it was just one flooding event after another as far as the rainfall amounts. And it fell over a wide area. So it was the core area was Missouri, Iowa, and Illinois. There was some of the heaviest rains in those areas, but a very large area that was impacted by that. And, of course, when it's raining all the time, it's not drying out. So, you know, you see very little sunshine. The temperatures are cooler. And so it was very hard to dry out from that episode as well.
The damage was quite significant in both human and property loss, about $36 billion worth of damage and 48 deaths. Now, looking back, was this preventable? Could we have done something different to mitigate the damage and maybe even prevent those deaths?
Unfortunately, a lot of it was not expected. If you look at the numbers, the rainfall amounts were, you know, kind of like the 500-year event and I think in some cases locally it was maybe even the 1,000-year event. So it's just the extreme of the extremes as far as the rainfall amounts and the flood levels as well. So that made it really hard to, like, design any kind of levee to withstand that. They just weren't able to deal with that kind of a rainfall event. And really, we hope it is a once-in-a-lifetime event. But we're not so sure now because we're moving towards wetter conditions across Illinois and the Midwest over the last century. So maybe we will see more events like this as we move forward. And in fact, just the other day we had, you know, 11 plus inches of rain up in Wisconsin.
Jim, for those of us who weren't there, what things still stick with you today?
Yeah, I think the big impression for me is that, yeah, I'm used to seeing, you know, river flooding where a river gets out of its banks, but I was not prepared to see the whole Mississippi floodplain fully flooded like that. So I looked out over the water there, and it looked more like Lake Erie than it did the Mississippi River. So it was just the extent of the flooding was just mind-boggling compared to what you might experience in a regular year. I remember we had a flight down to St. Louis, and basically the floodplain for the Mississippi and the Missouri and the Illinois basins were all flooded out. And so it was just one large area of floodwaters. There was really no distinction between where the floodwaters end and the actual rivers began.
Analyzing weather patterns and how we're seeing wetter conditions, do you think that we're prepared for another similar flood, another similar event?
We probably, unfortunately, are not prepared for those kind of events. And it would be really hard to be prepared for such a large event as the 93 flood. But even floods that are of a lesser extent have caused major problems in Illinois and elsewhere. We had flooding events, for example, back in 2008 that caused quite a bit of damage as well. And so, yeah, I think there's still issues we're wrestling with. And many of those issues involve levees and floodplains and wetlands and things like that we're still wrestling with. So I think that there's still a lot to be worked on.
I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm talking with Jim Angel, who is the state climatologist. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the Great Flood of 1993. But now let's turn to another event, completely opposite to the flooding. 30 years ago, most of central and southern Illinois faced a drought, known as the Drought of 88. Jim, what can you tell me about this event that happened 5 years before the 93 event?
That's right. So 5 years before, we had the worst flood on record. It had one of the worst droughts in recent memory. That was the 1988 drought. It was actually occurred in 1988 and spilled over into 1989. In 1988, we had a very dry spring, but the real concerns began about May, when we started to use up our soil moisture. And so we had a lack of rainfall, and it had already drawn down the soil moisture by May. So we started to see the impacts on crops by the May-June timeframe. And so the summer of 1988 was the main impacts were on the agricultural areas around the Midwest. And so we started to get some rains, especially in the later part of July and then in August, and got some recovery. But it was really too late for corn and soybeans at that point. So the primary impact was on crops. But there were issues with water supplies as we moved farther into the summer. And even the Mississippi and Illinois rivers started to run on the low side based on the dry conditions. In addition to that, we had a lot of hot weather as well. So we had a big bump in the number of days over 100 degrees. And so it was hot, dry conditions just aggravated what we were seeing on the ground. Now, by the time we got into fall, there was a little bit of recovery, but some water supplies didn't really recover until we got into 1989. Sometimes it takes a while for the water supplies to bounce back from those conditions. So It was a pretty major impact, both in Illinois and the Midwest.
That was 30 years ago, but during these last 30 years, we've had other smaller-scale droughts and floods. Now, are these patterns normal for the state?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we're seeing now in particular, maybe good news, bad news, the good news is because we're trending towards wetter conditions, we're actually seeing fewer of the big long-term droughts in Illinois. Many of our worst droughts were back in the 30s and 50s, and they're a little less common now. So that's the upside. The downside is that we're paying for it on the flooding side, where we're seeing more frequent flooding and more of these heavy rain events, so more of the 4-inch, the 6-inch, the 8-inch rainfall events over very large areas. And the other thing that we're seeing a lot of in the recent years is that some of these are happening out of season. So we're seeing in the last 2015, we had a big rainfall event right after Christmas, and that's very unusual. And this year, we had a big rain event in February that especially hard hit was southern Illinois. So, you know, those are typically not the time of years that you see big rainfall. You might see snow, but not rain. So those are some things moving forward that you got to keep in mind as we plan not only for what's happening right now, but what's going to happen in the future.
Jim Angel is Illinois' state climatologist, and he spoke with Daisy Contreras. Now we check in with Harvest Public Media. As corn and soybean farmers prepare for the harvest, many are unusually anxious. The crops in their fields are worth far less now than before the trade wars began. Many farmers fear the pain from scrambled global markets may be just beginning. And as Frank Morris reports, many say they've seen this movie before, and it ends badly for both farmers and taxpayers.
Farming is largely a business passed down through generations. So farmers like Dwayne Hund, out on his spread in the Kansas Flint Hills, tend to have long memories.
We call this Tractor Grandpa because back in 1937, my dad and my grandfather bought this tractor. It was new. Anyway, they purchased this tractor for $600, and they traded four mules to get it.
The tractor was more reliable than draft animals, and farmers love reliability. Vagaries of weather can make or break them, and so can markets. American farmers have worked for decades to lock in global customers for the food they produce. Hunt says trade wars threaten that work and remind him of what lots of farmers consider a catastrophic mistake by Washington nearly 40 years ago, the Soviet grain embargo.
The Soviets must understand our deep concern.
President Carter wanted to punish the Soviet Union for invading Afghanistan.
Trade with the Soviet Union will be severely restricted.
Carter slashed exports of U.S. wheat and corn to the USSR. Prices tumbled. Dwayne Hund remembers watching the bottom fall out.
Prices on the border trade for grains went down the limit for several days. Of course, we were all just stunned by it and didn't know what to do.
But other countries did. Argentina and Brazil, later Canada and Australia, stepped in to sell grain to the Soviets. Hund says the embargo missed its target.
What it did was, though, it sent a clear signal to the world that we can't depend on the United States to be a reliable trading partner.
Hund says the fallout lingered for years as investment and grain orders flowed to places like Brazil that have since become formidable international competitors. Many farmers think the 1980 Soviet grain embargo contributed to the worst farm crisis since the Great Depression.
We're looking for a lot of money to come in today, folks, for a great cause. So get on the phones now. That's 1-800-FARM-AID.
Soft commodity prices, plummeting land values, and sky-high interest rates drove thousands out of farming. And now the implications of losing export markets are back on farmers' minds. 40% of them, polled by Farm Futures, a trade publication, said that Trump trade policy is doing permanent damage to U.S. agriculture. You can count Paul Penner, past president of the National Association of Wheat Growers, among them.
It's very difficult how we're going to get back to square one once this trade war ends. How do you regain trust? How do you regain market share? How do you rebuild the agreements that were thrown away? That's the difficult issue.
Many farmers do appreciate Trump's opposition to environmental regulations and the tax cuts he signed. A lot of them remain hopeful that trade talks will produce favorable new agreements. Farmers like Dwayne Hund hate the uncertainty.
The impacts here are not short term. very likely will be long-term, and there's probably things that may come out of this that we don't even know and think through right now, and that's what bothers me.
The Soviet grain embargo offers some political lessons, too. All the farmers in this story, Hund, Ulrich, and Penner, voted for Jimmy Carter, a farmer, after all, the first time he ran for president. 4 years later, they all voted against him. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration focused on food, fuel, and the environment. The city of Springfield erupted in violence 110 years ago this month. A white mob set out to lynch two black men at the jail. When they found the men had been relocated, the mob attacked black neighborhoods, burning homes, and forcing out black residents. The violence reshaped the city and led to the founding of the NAACP. Rachel Otwell tells us what the community is doing to remember and to raise awareness.
The Springfield race riot was briefly famous around the world for the simple reason that it was in Abraham Lincoln's hometown. It kind of exemplified how far we had sunk with race relations. In fact, the crowd actually yelled something like, "Abe Lincoln brought you in, we will drive you out."
That's James Lowen, Central Illinois native, nationally renowned historian, and author of the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. During the riot, thousands of whites attacked black residents, destroying much of a black neighborhood. At least seven people died. The violence reshaped Springfield in ways felt even today, but many people don't know the story.
The question is, how do we get adults to realize that our children are not stupid and that just as we don't want to be lied to, neither do they?
A Springfield Schools spokesperson told me, "We currently do not have district-wide curriculum for the race riots of 1908, but it's not just kids who don't know the history. Leroy Jordan's worked for years to raise awareness of the violence a century ago. Jordan was one of the first African Americans on the local school board. He saw the district through a desegregation order in the 70s. We talk in a Baptist church on the east side of Springfield, where he's a longtime resident. It's a majority black and low-income area. Jordan says the people living here are still largely misunderstood. And as for the 1908 riot,
I think it was a massacre. It's been kept quiet for years and years and years, and I personally think that the truth needs to be told about it so that we don't repeat this craziness that's going on in our country even today.
In a way, this history was largely buried for decades. 4 years ago, archaeologists set out to see if any remains of the black-owned residences burned down by whites were under a parking lot that would be affected by construction on a nearby railroad. They uncovered foundations and artifacts, pieces of dishware, a toilet, clothing, and a cross. Jordan and others have called for the consecration of those building remains. Not far from those tracks is a busy intersection. One of the streets is called Reconciliation Way. The name came as part of citywide efforts a decade ago to reckon with the atrocities that happened in the riot, including two innocent black men being tortured and lynched. The city continues to take steps to commemorate the riot. Today, right by this intersection, city leaders are unveiling updated historical markers originally installed in the 90s. They're designed to be more visible, and they include quotes from both Obama and Lincoln.
We look at what happened in Charlottesville. Klansmen that took off their robes to say that we're gonna wear khakis and polos, but we still will carry our tiki torches. So we will let you black folks know that we will still burn you out.
That's Ken Page, a former president of the local NAACP chapter.
We look at how far we've come, but we also have to realize how far we still have yet to go.
It's still several years away, but the NAACP's current Illinois president is helping plan a new way to remember the riot. Teresa Haley says an interactive outdoor memorial / museum is set to be built over the foundations of those burned down homes near the railroad. Visitors will walk through informational panels and end at a sculpture based on one of the trees a man was hung from.
You walk through history. It's like a time capsule. So you go in one direction and you come out on the other side and you're breathless. You're speechless. It's like, wow, that was overwhelming. But that is our history. And also outside of it, we're going to have a healing garden.
Haley says the project, a major undertaking, is slated to be finished by 2025.
In the meantime, Haley says she and others will continue to unbury the past. She says it's all part of a larger goal to defeat racism. And she says there are two key ways to fight that battle.
One is to vote. Two is to talk and to educate people about it.
I'm Rachel Otwell, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment. This is Statewide. There is more to come. We'll hear what the horse racing industry is pushing for as a way to get more people out to the tracks. That's still ahead.